We are really, really privileged tonight to have a very special guest. We're really grateful. This guest is already, as I mentioned, he's been around the schools of Chapel Town this morning in Ecclesfield School and then in Chapel Town Academy, meeting some GCSE students and some A-level students. And tonight, he's here to meet you. Where do I start? Professor David Wilkinson has had quite a story. He did his first doctorate in astrophysics, and we'll ask him a bit about that in a moment. And then he went on to do a doctorate in theology. He's now based in Durham University, where he's principal of one of the colleges there. And today he's come down to Chapel Town to be with you. So can we just give it up, a really warm welcome to Professor Dr. David Wilkinson. Let's give him a really warm David, a very warm welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming here tonight. I don't know if it's an advantage or not, but we can't see folks very
absolutely
clearly with these lights.
It's an advantage.
I was going to say, you don't have the same advantage, at least on this side of the room. David, welcome and thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
Just for those of us who don't know much about you, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your family, that sort of thing.
I grew up in a mining village in northwest of Durham called Anfield Plain, and I went to Durham University where I studied first physics and then astrophysics, went on, did a bit of theology, and now we find ourselves back in the northeast where I work in Durham. I'm married to Alison, who's a Methodist minister. We have two children, Adam, who's 20, and Hannah, who's 18, who have just left, both of them, for university, so I've got the sofa back and the remote control, and it is great.
It sounds like you're coming to terms with that sense of loss, David.
It's very difficult, but one has to struggle through.
Great, that's lovely. Now, I guess not many of us have much idea about what it's like being principal of a Durham college. What's kind of good about it? What's best about being principal at St. John's?
I mean, we're really privileged in that we have some of the brightest and most amazing students to work with, and that's the day-by-day privilege of it. So I've just got one lad who started with us at the age of 19, who spent last year on the USPGA Tour in the States. He's now come to do a three-year degree. Well, one of my first-year students at the age of 19 has a two-book novel deal with Bloomsbury.
Wow.
I would have never got into university these days. Yeah. These are amazing young people. Yeah. That's part of it. Yeah. Yeah. But also, I think St. John's is a unique place in that we also, as well as looking after students for Durham University, we also train around about 80 church leaders. Yeah. And so we stand at the crossroads between church and university.
That's the kind of what sounds encouraging. What's most challenging about being responsible for, I mean, how many students is it under your care?
About 770 or so.
I guess there's some challenges there as well. What's the kind of toughest, if you like, about that?
Oh, gosh. I think one of the things as principal is that you're expected to be at everything. From the ultimate frisbee match at 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning to the baked bean throwing contest, or whatever it happens to be. So it's difficult balancing life and home and work, but I think that's true of many of us.
Now, David, obviously part of the reason you're here tonight, we're thinking very much about the whole area of science. What kind of, just tell us about your journey into physics and astrophysics. How did that happen?
I wish I could say that I'm one of these people who at the age of four built a telescope and was always into science. In fact, it's not, and if, as long as you don't tell anyone, I'll tell you the truth of the matter. When I thought about going to university, I wanted to do a subject that wouldn't take very much time, because my main interest was cricket, and Durham University was very good for cricket, and I thought, well, I was pretty good at mathematics, so if I did physics, I wouldn't have to go to the library, I wouldn't have to write essays, I'd have lots of time free for cricket and drinking cups of coffee. And just before I went to university, I became a Christian, and that made all of the difference to the way that I viewed physics.
Right. Can I just ask you a little bit about that? You say you became a Christian, so you weren't kind of a church-going background or anything like that?
Yeah, my parents had a church-going background, but I went through this kind of thing that lots of teenagers go through, which is I was really... I always believed in God, I think, but really struggled with the church.
Yeah.
And so wandered away, and then one or two things happened. I fell desperately in love with a girl in the local Christian youth group. And so started to go along to the youth group to try and go out with her. We never got to go out, but I saw amongst these Christian young people something that I didn't have. Yeah. And then Bob Dylan went through his Christian phase. Yes. I was really into the music of Bob Dylan. Yeah. Far better than Coldplay, by the way. But anyway.
Slow train coming.
That's right. Yeah. And I suddenly heard Jesus being sung about in a culture that made a connection with me. Up to that time, I thought you couldn't sing about Jesus unless you'd written in the 17th century or something of that sort. And then thirdly, I simply started to read the Bible for myself. Mm. I'd never done that before. Found most of it really quite difficult. But the thing that really struck me was this man, Jesus.
Now, let's just come back to the science for a minute. You got into astrophysics. Mm. Why was that?
Well, the universe is a pretty big place, and therefore there's lots of work to be done on it. I'm sure you all know what theoretical astrophysics is, by the way, don't you? It's really easy. It's twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. That's what astrophysics is. Trouble is that if you're an astrophysicist, you continue the rhyme by saying, up above the world so high, a contracting ball of hot hydrogen gas undergoing nuclear fusion. Doesn't quite rhyme in the same way. But I was interested in the science of it, because it's really interesting science. Yeah. But also I remember Arnold Wolfendale, who was my PhD supervisor, then Astronomer Royal, said to me, David, if you're interested in the God question, then in the universe, God's there all of the time. It was a really interesting thing to say.
Right. Yeah. Now, I'm sure you're going to say a little bit more about that, so I don't want to trespass on that. But so was that, what was then made the journey from, you were enjoying astrophysics to theology? Why go that way?
I mean, to be very blunt and hopefully not sounding pious, I just felt that that's what God wanted me to do. Yeah. I can't put it in any other way. Yeah. It wasn't as if I got to a stage where I was cheesed off with astrophysics or I was worried by the science. Yeah. That's never been the case for me. I've always enjoyed science. I'm still passionate about it. But I just felt that God wanted me to be involved in church leadership, as simple as that. And as I said my prayers and read my Bible and talked to other Christians, that was the message that came time and time again.
Yeah, great. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. If you can put this in terms we might understand. Your research in astrophysics was, just so folks don't know.
Yeah, I was interested in a number of areas. So one area was how stars form from big clouds of hydrogen. And then when those stars start to go through their life, how the chemicals in a galaxy change and how a galaxy evolves over billions of years. And then the Big Bang model of the universe. And even we got interested in why the dinosaurs died out, whether they were hit by a comet 65 million years or so ago. So a whole range of issues. In fact, one of my friends, when I said, what should I call my PhD thesis, replied, random thoughts concerning the universe. And lovely thing to do. Yeah.
And how about the theology? What did you study there? Was that random thoughts again? Or?
Well, lots of people would say that. And you'll probably say it by the end of this evening, I guess. I was interested in the concept of what God's purpose for the stuff around us actually is.
Right.
So when we think about the future, Christians have often thought about what the future of human life is. But actually, does God have a purpose for the universe as a whole? What is all of this stuff that he's made? And what I was particularly interested in was that the dominant image in the New Testament is not of a kind of heaven up there, but it's of new creation, a new heaven and a new earth, which God wants to transform this creation into.
Right.
So that's what I worked on.
Great. David, thank you. I've got one more question, perhaps the most important of all.
Yeah.
I'm told that you are a supporter of a particular football team.
Absolutely.
Do you want to just tell us about that?
It's Newcastle United.
Oh, there's a few cheers.
We've been season ticket holders at St. James's Park. Well, it's been called various things over the time we've been season ticket holders. And my wife and I are there and we'll be there tomorrow.
David, I would express my condolences.
At the moment, we do need condolences, and it's a difficult time. It really weeds out the true supporters or
absolutely,
not.
Absolutely. David, one final question, actually. This is the very final one, because I want to hand over to you now. The question I guess a lot of people are asking is, how can you be a scientist and a Christian?
Thank you.
And I think you have a little presentation about that.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about that just for a little bit, Rick, if that's all right with everyone. Because that question is often asked. I was on a train not so long ago and sat down, and the person beside me introduced themselves and said, what do you do? Well, I said, I'm a Methodist minister and I teach theology at Durham University. I'm always a little hesitant about saying that to people because you never quite know what people's reaction will be. And this man's eyes seemed to fill with fear as he thought to himself, oh no, all the way to London sitting beside this religious fanatic. So he quickly tried to change the topic of conversation. He said, what did you do before that? I said, I did research in theoretical astrophysics. This time his eyes glazed as he thought to himself, what on earth does he mean by that? But he knew it was something to do with science. And so he asked me that question. How can you be a scientist and a Christian? Or actually subtitled, how can you be a scientist and a Christian with integrity? You see, you can do it by living two different lives, one on a Sunday and one Monday to Saturday. But when I first became a Christian, one of the things that really struck me was that Christian proclamation that Jesus is Lord. And if he was Lord, he was Lord not just of what I did on Sunday morning, but what I did on Monday to Saturday. He was Lord not just of my heart, but my mind. And so part of my own experience has been to try and ask the question, how can you be a scientist and a Christian with integrity? But we live in a culture where science and Christian faith are put often in conflict with one another. One of the great things about being a scientist today is that scientists have become cool again. One of the great comedy series of our time is The Big Bang Theory. And in The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, the theoretical physicist, is often shown in conversation with his mother, who is a six-day creationist from Texas. And the comedy is about playing the two of them off against one another. Let me show you a clip from The Big Bang Theory. This is Sheldon and his mother, as Sheldon's mother is going to go on a Christian cruise.
So what kind of cruise is this you're going on?
It's called the Born Again Boat Ride. Christian Quarterly gave it their highest rating, 5 thorny crowns. I do wish you'd come with me, Sheldon.
Well, Mom, if I did, it would be conclusive proof that your God can work miracles.
You're missing out. It's going to be wall-to-wall fun. It's all themed. There's Jonah and the whale watching. All-you-can-eat last supper buffet. And my personal favorite, gunning with God.
What's gunning with God? I'm afraid to ask.
Oh, it is a hoot and a half. You write your sins on a clay pigeon, they fire them up in the air, and you pulverize them with a 12-gauge shotgun full of our Lord's forgiveness.
Frankly, Mom, I'm encouraged to see how advanced your group has become. You're willing to sail out into the ocean without fear of falling off the edge.
For example, if Shelley was aboard, he'd ride Smart Mouth on his pigeon. And then, bam!
The Lord giveth and the Lord bloweth away.
And everywhere you look in comedy today, whether it be in the stand-up routines of Dara O'Brien or Eddie Izzard or Ricky Gervais, you see often science and faith put in opposition to one another. Now, I've never felt that myself. I have to say that science has found difficult questions to ask of my faith, and my faith has often asked difficult questions of my science. But my testimony is that those questions have ultimately been fruitful rather than destructive to both my excitement with science and my excitement with faith. So I thought I'd talk just a little bit about how I try and hold them together with integrity, if that's all right with everyone. I mean, I hope it is, because that's what I've prepared. So it's not, we're in a problem. And first of all, I think I've got to be clear that I've needed to recognize what I would call inadequate arguments. I don't want to pulverize them with a 12-bore shotgun or anything like that, but I do just want to recognize that sometimes these arguments in this area don't work. The first is the kind of argument which says, let me prove God to you through science. And you've probably heard this kind of argument, because I've worked on the Big Bang, and lots of people have used this when it comes to the Big Bang. The type of argument that goes, if the universe began with a Big Bang, who lit the blue touch paper? Who set it off? Have you heard that kind of argument? Who put the stuff there in order for it to go bang in the first place? And that's a very attractive argument. It's used a lot. But I think it's got a real difficulty. The difficulty is something called God of the Gaps. Charles Coulson talked about this many years ago. And often that argument is used because we don't have a full scientific description of something. And the trouble is, if science has a gap in it, people want to insert God as the explanation into the gap. The trouble is, as science explains more and more of its own area, so God is pushed out and becomes irrelevant. That's God of the Gaps. But the God I believe in, the God that I experience, the God of the New Testament, is not a God who simply lights the blue touch paper of the firework of the Big Bang and then goes off for a cup of tea, not to have anything more to do with it. It's a God who holds the universe in the palm of his hand, keeping it in existence moment by moment. So a writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews said, he upholds the universe by his word of power. God is the one who sustains every moment of the universe's history. And actually, I'm really excited by science's ability to describe this universe. Kepler, the great astronomer, said, science is thinking God's thoughts after him. And I don't think that you can use science to prove God through a God of the Gaps type argument. The second is also something that's often said down the conversation, down the pub. And that is, you can disprove God through science. And this is the argument with respect that Professor Dawkins and others use. And they put science and faith in opposition. And they say, science says one thing about the universe. The Bible says another thing about the universe. And then they pause and say, now, which are you going to choose? Which one? Seems to me that this is far too simplistic. So to use an old illustration, what is a scientific definition of a kiss? Well, a kiss is the approach of two pairs of lips, the reciprocal transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes, the juxtaposition of two orbicular muscles in a state of contraction. That is a kiss. But if I go to my wife and say, Alison, let me get together with you for a mutual transmission of carbon dioxide and microbes. Let me juxtapose my orbicular muscle in state of contraction with yours. Well, I won't tell you what she would say to me. You see, in that context with my wife, I talk about a kiss in terms of meaning, value, purpose. Which is the true definition of a kiss? Is it the one about purpose, or is it the one about carbon dioxide and microbes? Actually, both are true, but different. And to fully understand a kiss, I need to understand both. And so when it comes to, say, the scientific description of the origin of the universe, it doesn't have to be that you've got to put it against the Bible. It may be that the scientific description is complementary to the scientific description. And indeed, within science, I don't find any real answers to meaning, value, or purpose of the universe. The third inadequate argument is the kind of argument that goes, science has always been in conflict with religion. And this happens all of the time. It's people who say, well, wasn't Galileo all about the Bible against science? And wasn't Charles Darwin all against the Bible and science? And people believe that science and faith have always been in conflict. But the truth of the matter is very different. It's much more complicated than that. And actually really interesting. I don't know if you know how old this conflict model of science and religion is. Well, actually, it's only about 100 years old. It was invented in 1864 by a man called Thomas Henry Huxley. Huxley was Darwin's bulldog. That's why Dawkins, by the way, is sometimes called Darwin's Rottweiler. Huxley was a person who wanted to take Darwinian evolution and use it for a particular purpose. And in 1864, he founded a secret society. It was called the X Club. And this secret society had an issue. The issue was, with respect, Rick, that the Church of England was far too influential in modern science. You see, in my own university, Durham, if you wanted to be professor of astronomy at Durham University in the 19th century, you had to be an ordained Anglican vicar. If you were to be the president of the British Association of Science, you had to be ordained. In fact, really, you had to be a bishop in order to be head of the British Association of Science. And Huxley and his friends said, with this new science, we want science to have its own area. So how do we move science and the church apart? And they created this conflict model. And they got a number of folk to literally rewrite the history of science and religion under titles like The Warfare of Science and Religion. In fact, Galileo was far more interesting. Here he is, looking through his telescope. Galileo made a bit of money by selling his telescope to the Venetian Parliament so they could see opposing navies coming towards them. And then he pointed his telescope to the sky, and this is his observation of the moons of Jupiter. This is his notebook. You can see here the large circle, that's Jupiter, and then the little dots, which were the moons of Jupiter. And this was very important for Galileo because it gave him a kind of model that the solar system could be like this, with the sun at the center and the planets going around. And people then say, well, didn't the church oppose this? No. Galileo was motivated to do this by his Christian faith. He was a committed Christian. And the really interesting thing about Galileo was why he pointed his telescope to the sky in the first place. Now, we have grown up with science and we know what it's about. But why do you do that? Well, up to the time of Galileo, the Greek view of science was that you worked out the universe from logic, from elegance. That's why Aristotle had the Earth at the center and all of the planets on crystalline spheres going round. And Aristotle said the universe must be on shape of spheres because that's the most logical way. And Galileo said, if I believe in God, God is free to create however he wants to. And the only way to find out what the universe is like is to look at the universe to find out what it was about. That's observation, or empirical science as we now know it. And it came out of Galileo and others' Christian conviction. The fourth thing, inadequate argument, is that Christians have faith while scientists have evidence. You might have heard this sort of thing as well. The type of thing that says, well, science is all about facts, but Christianity is about just believing. You know, that old school definition of faith, that faith is believing those things you know aren't true. I mean, is that what it's about? So that I go into the lab on a Monday, I look at the facts, but on a Sunday, as I come into church, I throw my brain out and just believe. I've never experienced that. First of all, science is quite a messy business. It involves facts and theory. It involves judgments about really difficult weighing of evidence. There's a sense in which science itself involves faith, trust. and for me, as I'll come on to in a moment. I'm a Christian because of evidence. And I want to be really clear about that this evening. The reason I was drawn into Christian faith was in part because I saw what was going amongst Christian young people. I read the New Testament about this man Jesus. So what's the evidence for me as a scientist? And this is the second part of what I want to say. I think I've recognized evidence that needs to be interpreted. This isn't evidence to try and prove to you God this evening in any way, but to say that there are certain things which actually encourage me to make a judgment. The first is some pointers from science. And first of all, the laws of physics. Why do they work? Why are they so beautiful? Why can we understand them? This is a photograph of a cluster of galaxies. And it's a beautiful photograph. What you have is a number of galaxies. Each of these galaxies has 100 billion stars in them. By the way, they're one of 100 billion galaxies in the universe. It's a pretty big place. And these galaxies here are in the foreground, and you might just be able to see some thin shards of light just around. And those are effects produced by galaxies much, much further away. And the light from those galaxies is bent by a theory called general relativity, the warping of space-time. And we can understand that. And in the next 3 hours, I'm going to describe the mathematics to you. Many of my friends in science will say, where do the laws of physics themselves come from? And that's a big question. And science doesn't explain that. It assumes the laws of physics. So if Professor Hawking comes along and says, the universe came about through a quantum fluctuation, we can say, but where does quantum theory itself come from? Where do the laws of physics come from? Second, something called anthropic balances, or as Paul Davis puts it, the Goldilocks effect. Why are things just right for life to exist? In the 1960s, Sir Fred Hoyle, famous cosmologist, was an atheist. And partly he opposed Big Bang theory because he didn't like what it meant for belief in God. And then he did some work. It was really fantastic work. He should have gotten the Nobel Prize for it, but he didn't. And what he did was he looked at what happens when stars come to the end of their lives. This is a supernova explosion, or the remnant of a supernova explosion. It happens when a star slightly larger than our sun gets carried away with itself towards the end of its life and literally explodes. And what happens in this explosion is that certain elements like carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen are produced. The atoms of carbon that are in my body tonight were once produced in one of these supernova explosions at an earlier stage in the galaxy. That's a sobering thought for a Friday night, isn't it? But what Sir Fred found was that this process of producing carbon is dependent on some very important balances, that things have to be just right, as Goldilocks would say, in order for this process to work. If the energy levels in oxygen were just 0.5% different, and the energy levels in carbon were just 2% different, there would be no carbon in the universe. And that's quite serious for you and me, because we're made of this stuff. Sir Fred wrote after this, "Nothing has shaken my atheism as much as this discovery, that the universe is just right." Now, he didn't go on to become a Christian, but he found himself thinking, what is the deeper story to the universe? And then this thing called intelligibility. As Albert Einstein once said, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. You've got to think about that for a moment or two. I mean, why is that? Why can we understand the universe at such a fundamental level? Why does the mathematics of our mind resonate with the mathematics of the universe? Again, a number of physicists find themselves saying there must be a deeper story to the universe. And then what about this sense of awe? When you see the vastness of the universe, what do we do with this sense of awe? Have you ever been away from all of this street lighting and seen the Milky Way galaxy stretching across the sky? 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy, each as large as our own sun, and one of 100 billion galaxies, I remember, I said. This sense of awe. Now, of course, if you work in science, and I met some guys right at the back who work in science at various levels, you will know as well as I do that science is not often an awe-inspiring experience. It's tedious, it's boring, it's about experiments that don't work, it's about research students who don't do what you tell them to do, it's about funding that doesn't come through, it's about papers that are rejected by journals. But there are moments. John Hapgood, the former Archbishop of York, who himself was a research chemist, talked about them as core look-at-that moments, where you just see that under the complexity of the universe are some very beautiful, simple laws. These, I think, for me, are pointers towards the belief that there's a deeper story to the universe. And certainly, for those who believe in a creator God, they're fully consistent with belief in a God who created the universe. But that's not the only basis of why I believe in God. Second is what we often call historic revelation. The fact that the God of the Christian faith has spoken. A number of years ago, a physicist called John Taylor wrote a book about black holes. In it, he talked a little bit, not just about black holes, but why he didn't believe in God. And his argument went, the universe is pretty big. In fact, it's close to infinite. Our minds are small and finite. How can our minds ever understand not just the universe, but a God who created the universe? Because God himself must be infinite. How can a finite mind ever understand an infinite God? And Professor Taylor said, actually, we can't. Therefore, there's no point in talking about God. Therefore, we may as well say that God doesn't exist. Now, he's got a point up to a point, if you see my point. And that is, how can a finite mind like ours ever understand an infinite God? But, says the Christian, with respect, Professor Taylor, what if the infinite God decided to reveal himself to the finite mind in a way that the finite mind could understand? Now, that's a logical possibility. In fact, for the Christian faith, it's a central tenet that this infinite God has revealed himself to us in a way that we can understand. And the letter to the Hebrews says that God has done this in many and various ways, but supremely through his Son, Jesus. You see, when I read the stories of the New Testament, there was much that I didn't understand, but I was drawn by this man, Jesus. And yet I couldn't simply explain him as a man. It seemed to me the only reasonable explanation for what he said, what he taught, how he lived, how he died, and his raising from the dead could only be explained if this was God himself walking the pages of history. And so as a scientist, when I come to the resurrection and the empty tomb, I can't understand how the resurrection physically happened. I can't give you a scientific theory of that. But what I am trained to do as a scientist is to assess the evidence. And the evidence that the tomb was empty, the appearances to the disciples, the little things, the fact that the first women were witnesses, the growth of the Christian church, all of these things give me a weight of evidence, which means that the only reasonable interpretation of it for me is that Jesus was raised from the dead. Jesus was who he said he was. And this is the importance of me of historic revelation, that God has spoken. In fact, he's done more than spoken. He's walked the pages of history in Jesus. But there's one other thing. And that's religious experience. that this God is not simply a faraway creator. In fact, as a teenager, I used to believe in that kind of God, a God who maybe created the universe but really didn't get involved in human affairs. What I found at the age of 17, in a little communion service in a Methodist chapel, was this God spoke to me. There wasn't a rumble of thunder. There wasn't God is love written in the stars or anything like that. But a real sense of this God alive and loving me and calling me to follow him. Now, of course, as a scientist, when it gets to personal relationships, I'm a little limited. Well, in more ways than one, if you know what I mean. But if I ask the question, can I prove that my wife loves me? Well, actually, no, I can't. I can look for evidence of whether she loves me. Does she buy me a Valentine's card? That might tell me something. Alternatively, does she scream and run out the room every time she sees me? That would give me a certain amount of evidence. But the only way I know that she loves me is if on the basis of a certain amount of evidence, I'm prepared to trust myself into a relationship. And at that point, I know that I'm loved. And I got to a stage where, on the basis of a certain amount of evidence, it became quite clear that I simply had to trust and follow Jesus. Not just as historical character, but as risen Lord and Savior. And it's ultimately because of Jesus that I believe that you can be a scientist and a Christian. Rick, I hope that's all right. I hope that just kind of gets us away and gives people a chance for some conversation and criticism and dialogue and talk and lots of tweets and texts and all the rest of it. Is that okay?
David, that's been really, really helpful. If you've enjoyed that anything like as much as I have, why don't we just give it up again for David? That was lovely. Thank you.